Down to Business with Bobby Kerr on News Talk.
Sponsored by Bank of Ireland.
An end of civilization threat, a TACO, be it temporary or not, we shall see, a peace process in Pakistan, and an Epstein bombshell from Melania Trump. I'm joined by Scott Lucas, Professor and Political Analyst at the Clinton Institute in UCD. Scott, good morning and welcome.
Very good morning to you, Pat.
Now, let's talk about the last week. It's been a very dramatic week in American and international politics, but I suppose the starting point must be the Easter Sunday rant, the obscenities from Donald Trump, which surprised everybody. Even, I suppose, his harshest critics were surprised by that.
I think yes and no, Pat. I mean, the threat to end Iranian civilization, you know, it dies tonight. Yeah, it reaches a new low in terms of what Trump does. But I think it's a real marker of just how angry and frustrated he had become after more than a month and he wasn't able to get regime surrender. You know, Trump is fundamentally a bully. We've known that for decades as a businessman, as a politician. And yet he was meeting someone that wouldn't concede to him, despite the immense damage that the U.S. and Israel have caused, including the assassination of many of Iran's leaders. And yet they still stood. And so, you know, he just lashes out and says, well, that's it. You know, all hell breaks loose. And then says, magnifying this, you know, I don't care if it's war crimes. You know, I absolutely don't care. I think there was even a little bit of a backlash in America, and even among some, you know, folks who might normally support Trump, that he had just gone this far, however. And then, of course, as you know, within 24 hours, he flips from the destruction of Iranian civilization to declaring world peace. Because he says he'll enter talks with the Iranians on the basis of Iran's proposal, not the 15-point U.S. ultimatum.
Now, one of the curious things, I suppose, is the rather muted reaction in mainstream American media to this kind of carry-on. I mean, the French were absolutely emphatic in their public commentary. This man is unhinged. It was a headline in a British newspaper as well. I mean, he clearly is not well. And on Monday at his usual press conference, he was asked about his own mental health. And his answer was something like, well, if I'm mad, we're going to need a whole pile of more of mad guys to get the job done.
No, I mean, it's this process of normalizing Trump, which, you know, even when he is not normal, let's just be honest here. And you know, we can talk at another time about the physical and mental issues that are clearly there. But it happens at two levels. One is that Trump's own defenders, and I've just heard this all week from them in the United States, from them in the UK, which is, oh, well, you know, there's a strategy here. There's tactics here. It's like Nixon's madman theory in the 1970s. No, it's not. You know, there is no diplomatic rationale here. There is no strategy here. There are no tactics here. This is Trump just simply being Trump, irrational, if you will. But then that second level, you're right to highlight the media, and that is in contrast to where they got with Joe Biden, where, of course, any slip-up Biden was picked up, and towards the end, quite rightfully, in terms of a sign of his mental faculties, the media is like, both sizing it, which is, well, if we say that this is a bit, you know, unusual, a bit distinctive, we've got to come back and give some type of rationale that might try to explain it. And it's at some point, you have to hold your hand up, if you're going to be an analyst, at least, or a proper journalist, and just say, no, you don't just simply, you know, bring in a false equivalence here to try to explain this in terms of some logic that didn't exist in the first place. You know, there was no logic for Trump's destruction here. There was just simply a man who was ranting, who probably does have some mental issues and happens to be president of the United States.
Now, there is more and more talk of the 25th Amendment, which would remove him from office without him needing to be deceased. What exactly is the 25th Amendment and how would it work?
Yeah, so the 25th Amendment was brought in, Pat, historically because of the episode that we had where, you know, Franklin Roosevelt, you know, had been elected to a historic fourth term in the United States. Later on, of course, you get the two-term limit on being president, but not at that point. He dies very suddenly in office. And then folks start thinking, well, wait a minute, we need to have a process here for not just an orderly succession in terms of if the president is suddenly killed, but if the president can't carry out his duties, what exactly is the process by which this is declared in being in place? Because there's one obvious issue here, and that is a president may not decide, you know, may not say, oh, look, I'm not in possession of my faculties here. I'm not able to do this. You know, president wants to hang on. And so it provides, starting with the idea that you have to have a clear majority of his cabinet who actually have to stand up to him and say, look, no, you can no longer carry on the job. And if they can do that, then you can go through the process of succession, of course, where you go to the vice president, you know, as the person who takes over while the president is sort of pushed aside. It has never been invoked. It has been mentioned recurrently with Trump, even going back to the first term. But to be practical about this, Pat, who in the Republican Party is going to be the one to tell Trump to think it's time for you
now,
to go?
The problem with the 25th Amendment, I suppose, in his case, if he decides to fight it, you then go to the Senate and the House, and they need a two-thirds majority in both houses to get rid of him. And that, even in the face of obvious madness, is not likely to be forthcoming from the Republicans.
Well, I think if the cabinet, if you had, you know, the cabinet which said he could no longer serve, then that changes because it obviously, you know, the cabinet are effectively devoted to Trump. They're his loyalists. But you're absolutely right, Pat. You know, the fact here is that despite everything we've seen in the last few weeks, not just about the war on Iran and across the Middle East, but about the way that Trump has approached the issue of immigration, the way that he has ranted about the economy, his unbelievable. You talk about unhinged. The tweet the night before last, where he just issued vicious, vicious insult after insult against people who used to support him, like Tucker Carlson, like Megyn Kelly, like Marjorie Taylor Greene. Despite that, very few Republicans will dare speak out. There were a handful of senators earlier this week that spoke out about the death to Iranian civilization tweet. But when you have 53 Republican senators, and of course you've got around 218, 219 Republican representatives. Where are the rest of you folks when you're needed?
Now, the question of the war and why it was prosecuted in the first place, and all the smart money says this was Netanyahu's scheme all along, his wish for some 40 years to obliterate Iran, and finally he got a compliant president, and the notion that Netanyahu calls the shots, and we even saw a flavour of that when the ceasefire was invoked, and initially, obviously, Trump and his team thought that Lebanon was included until Netanyahu said, oh, no, it's not.
Yeah, Pat, I'm more of the line of that. These are two groups, the Netanyahu folks and Trump's folks, who have a convergence, and they sort of tug on each other. It's not that one dominates the other. And just that quick reminder that, you know, we had the 12-day Israeli war back in June of 2025 against Iran, and the Americans joined it, you know, with the bunker buster bombs against nuclear facilities. But then on the 12th day, Donald Trump came in and told Netanyahu to stop because the Iranians played him. The Iranians, you know, carried out a demonstration attack on a U.S. airbase, told the personnel to evacuate in advance, but they won sort of Trump's favor at that point to stop it. Now, in this case, you know, it is true that on February 26th, the U.S. was in talks with the Iranians. 2 days later, they joined the Israeli war and they killed the Supreme Leader. But there are clear American motives here for doing this. I don't agree with them, of course. But the fact here is that Israel wanted regime change. The Trump folks wanted regime surrender. They wanted the regime to give up their nuclear program, give up their ballistic missile program, give up their ties across the Middle East to show American dominance. So rather than saying Netanyahu dragged Trump into the war, there's an echo here of what happened in 2003 over Iraq, where you had the claim of weapons of mass destruction, that pretext for the Americans to try to show dominance. Then you saw that didn't go well. Now here we are in 2026, it's not going well. But you are right that just because the Americans then say we need to have a ceasefire to get some breathing space, the Israelis continue the attacks across southern Lebanon, despite a phone call from Donald Trump to Benjamin Netanyahu a couple of days ago saying we need you to back off this for a bit.
Well, finally, Netanyahu decided that, okay, we'll try and have talks here to disarm the the Hezbollah in Lebanon. We'll see how all of that goes. Meantime, in Pakistan, J.D. Vance is leading, we think he's leading, but Jared Kushner is also there, leading the peace talks with Iran, chaired by the Pakistanis, that's starting today. How do you think that's going to go?
At best, Pat, these are talks about talks. And you get an extension of the two-week ceasefire. And that's because we don't even have a real agreement on the agenda. On Tuesday night, the way this played out on social media, you know, 88 minutes before his deadline to blow up Iranian civilization, Donald Trump flips. But he not only says he's going to accept talks, he did it on the basis, not on the 15-point U.S. ultimatum, but on the 10-point Iranian plan. Well, the Iranians are saying, you know, we're going to keep a civilian nuclear program. We are going to maintain oversight of the Strait of Hormuz, even if we allow freedom of navigation. We're not going to discuss ballistic missiles. We're not going to discuss our links with other groups across the region. And we want an end to sanctions, and we want reparations for damage, and we want Americans to leave military bases. Mm. Now, the Americans aren't going to agree to all that, but Trump had said this is the basis for the talks. That meant on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, the White House is trying to row back from that and say, no, the 10-point plan is not the basis for the talks. It's a different proposal he agreed to. And so pretty much this is for show today, Pat. Now, it's an important show. The Iranians show that they have survived as a regime. But more interestingly, J.D. Vance, who opposed this war in the first place, shows that he is now a player. In other words, that he is seeking an off-ramp. Because I'll leave you with this stinger, Pat. The most important issue for the Americans after more than 6 weeks has not become Iran's nuclear program, Iran's ballistic missile program, Iran in the Middle East. Because of their miscalculations, their complete failure in preparation and tactics, the most important issue for them is that Iran now controls the Strait of Hormuz and therefore has a hold on the world's oil and gas supplies.
Now, two other issues. One very dramatic when Melania made her speech from the White House saying nothing to do with Epstein at all, casual acquaintances, mix in the same social circles. Anything you hear about me and Epstein is untrue. Very dramatic and very unprecedented, I would have thought.
Very dramatic, very unprecedented, very unexpected, because it was only hours before that took place. The press were notified she would make a statement, weren't told about the content. She was up there for less than 6 minutes. And then it gets very interesting because she sets herself at a distance from her husband. First and foremost, she wants to protect herself. And I have to say here that there is no evidence to counter her claims that, you know, she met Jeffrey Epstein through her husband, or sorry, through at that point her boyfriend, Donald Trump, in 2000. She never had any connection with Epstein's criminal activities. But she goes further. Because there was an email that had surfaced about her exchange, about an email exchange she had with Ghislaine Maxwell, Epstein's associate in 2002, she's saying, oh, this was just a courtesy email. Because it wasn't. It was an extremely friendly exchange. Melania saying to Maxwell, dear G, J.E., Epstein looked great on the cover of New York Magazine. Here you're going to Palm Beach, maybe I can see you. Ghislaine Maxwell calling her sweet pea. So there was that friendly connection that was there, and Melania's trying to push that aside because, and again, I think this is the key point, she's saying, I'm protecting myself first rather than my husband, because she says the survivors should now have their voices heard in Congress. In other words, let's let the stories come out. Who doesn't want that to happen? Donald Trump.
And there is another wrinkle in all of this. Is a story emanating from Brazil. I don't know whether you saw it. A woman who was deported by ICE on the instructions of her husband, who's a pal of Donald Trump, and she says she's going to spill all the beans.
Yeah, and we will see, because there's certainly a lot of smoke that's out there. Now, whether there's fire that takes place, we wait and see. But I think the key part here is what Melania had done, whether or not she wanted to do it, is even at a time of the U.S. Israel war on Iran and on Lebanon, she puts Epstein back up the news cycle. And if we do get a ceasefire that lasts, guess which story is going to resurge? So Trump can try to run from this, but he cannot hide.
The last topic, and briefly, is about a Democrat. The Democrat who's running for the governorship of California to succeed Gavin Newsom, a man called Eric Swalwell. He is already a congressman. And four women have come up alleging sexual misconduct by him while he was a congressman. And already the Democrats in California have distanced themselves from him. So a bit of trouble there for the Dems.
Oh, yeah. You know, very much them, you know, because even if the current president of the United States is someone who's been effectively convicted of sexual assault, it's a different rule for the Democrats. They've got to put themselves, you know, basically in the clear again, especially with the Epstein case circulating in terms of allegations of sexual harassment. That said, Eric Swalwell, who was a representative, had quite a bit of profile. But the Democrats do have a series of other candidates who have got quite good reputations. You might look at someone like Katie Porter, who is a former U.S. representative as well. I think Javier Becerra, who is the former Health and Human Services Secretary and Attorney General of California. I think the question here is you have a sort of an open primary in California. So irrespective of party, the top two people go forward to the final race. Do they have a candidate amongst the Democrats who can go up against Steve Hilton? Because he's pretty much the clear Republican. Yeah. All the Republicans have rallied behind him as their Trumpist candidate.
Scott Lucas, professor and political analyst at the Clinton Institute at UCD. Thank you very much, Scott, for joining us on the program.
Thank you, Pat.
Down to business with Bobby Kerr.
Sponsored by Bank of Ireland.
Saturday morning at 8. News Talk. Conversation that counts.